Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard at the Science Museum in central London, and this special edition of the Global News Podcast is being recorded on Saturday, the 20th of July, exactly 50 years since this happened.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
In this extended podcast, we will be celebrating the extraordinary effort that took people to the moon, the dedicated team of scientists who made it happen, the political atmosphere driving the mission.
We were in a zero-sum Cold War competition with the Soviet Union.
And the impact it had for those watching on Earth.
Oh, boy. What?
We're going to be busy for a minute.
I'm speechless.
Also, half a century on, why space exploration remains crucial.
We need a backup plan. Plan B. An insurance policy.
What has the space program meant for popular culture?
To infinity and beyond!
And what's been the legacy of the moon landings? Hello, I am out of the studio and at the Science Museum in London as the world celebrates the anniversary of the most extraordinary achievement. It's exactly 50 years since Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first people to set foot on the moon. It was a triumph of political will, scientific brilliance and personal bravery. And it was a moment that brought the world together and inspired a generation. Palab Ghosh looks back.
This is Apollo 9's control. We're still aiming toward our planned liftoff at the start of the lunar window, 9:32 a.m.
As if bathed in a divine light, standing 111 metres tall, the Saturn V rocket shimmers on Launch Pad A at the Kennedy Space Centre.
This is Apollo 9's control. T-minus 3 hours, 4 minutes, 32 seconds and counting.
In their spacesuits, Commander Neil Armstrong leads Edwin Buzz Aldrin and Mike Collins into the spacecraft. Their world is divided by wars, conflict and social change, sentiments reflected in the number one single of that day.
The instigator, because there's something in the air.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1... 0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Oh boy, it looks good, Wally.
We've got a roll program.
Neil Armstrong reporting the roll and pitch program, which puts Apollo 11 on a proper heading.
12 minutes later, the astronauts are in orbit and they're on their way.
Hello, Apollo 11, Houston. We'd like you to press on to Star 44, over.
A few days later, Apollo 11 arrives at its destination. But as Eagle approaches the lunar surface, Armstrong notices that the spacecraft is off course, headed not for the pre-planned landing site, but terrain littered with dangerous boulders.
Stand by.
The flight director asked his control team to call out whether it was go or no-go for landing.
Flight controllers, go, no go for landing. Retro.
Go.
Righto.
Go.
Guidance.
Go.
Control.
Neil Armstrong decided to take manual control of the vehicle and proceed with the landing.
30 feet, 2.5 down. Fake shadow. 4 forward, drift into the right a little.
Buzz Aldrin then spoke the first words ever said by a person on another world.
Contact light. Okay, engine stop.
And then Armstrong confirmed what an anxious mission control had wanted to hear.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Armstrong made his descent onto the lunar surface.
I'm going to step off the limb now.
And uttered the words that would reverberate through history forevermore.
It's one small step for man. One giant leap for mankind.
And you know that it's right. We have got to get it together.
The astronauts planted America's flag, but it was an achievement for all humanity. It was a time when all things seemed possible. The very stars seemed within our grasp, only for plans for the human exploration of other worlds to fade. But long after the Apollo program was scrapped, Neil Armstrong told me that he believed that sooner or later, humans would go back to the moon, and perhaps even beyond.
The dream remains. The reality is fading a bit, but it will come back in time.
As NASA's Apollo 11 mission landed on the moon and Neil Armstrong took the first steps on the lunar surface, the world watched in awe. But what was going through the minds of all those back at Mission Control in Houston? Among them was NASA flight controller Jerry Griffin.
Mission Control was made up of a bunch of young people. I was 34, and I was one of the older guys. We felt that nobody's ever done this, so let's just do it. And we knew the world was pulling for us.
Apollo 11, Houston, you're good at 1 minute.
It was a routine. Apollo 11 was extremely clean.
Eagle, Houston, we see you on the steerable, over. You're a go for landing, over.
Roger, understand. Go for landing. 3,000 feet.
The final phases of the descent of Apollo 11 were kind of fraught. We had two computer alarms, 1202 and a 1201 alarm, saying that the computer is being overworked.
1201.
Roger, 1201 alarm.
So it was not a good thing. Luckily, for the last simulation before we actually launched the mission, we had seen them. And when it came up with the flight, the guys knew more about it. They took a quick look to make sure that all the guidance was correct, but quickly gave them a go. By the way, the young man that made that call was in his 20s.
1201 alarm.
Stand tight, we're go flight.
Okay, we're go.
We're go.
So it was dicey there at the end, and then they started running short of fuel, and we were concerned.
60 seconds.
We heard calls that said you got 60 seconds, 30, and Neil never responded. It was nerve-wracking. It was in Neil Armstrong's hands at that point.
40 feet down, 2.5, picking up some dust.
And I never will forget when Buzz Aldrin said we were picking up some dust. That's when I thought, we're going to make it. We got an engine blowing dust off the moon.
Contact light. Okay, engine stop. We copy you down, Eagle.
Neil told me one time, he said, it's like an automobile. When it's on empty, there's a little bit left in the tank.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
When they first touched down, it was a great relief. I remember being proud, kind of a proud feeling. By golly, we did it.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
Of course, the television picture was pretty grainy and not very easy to look at, but I think everybody was just kind of awestruck. There was very little being said in that room.
I'm at the foot of the ladder.
He first actually got down to the footpad, and he was standing on the footpad. I think he'd already decided what he was going to say, but I think he wanted to make sure that he was kind of calm enough and not too excited, which he never was, to say it plainly.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And when he said what he said and stepped off on the surface, I remember thinking, vintage Neil. You knew he was going to come up with something profound.
It has a stark beauty all its own. It's like much of the high desert of the United States. It's different, but it's very pretty out here.
The thing I remember most from when they went out was when they planted the flag and talked to the president.
Hello, Neil and Buzz. I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House.
And I hear these two guys were standing on the moon talking to President Nixon in the Oval Office. Wow, you know, it worked. The scientists were jumping up and down, stop all this and get samples and so forth, which I understood their side of the story too. But I thought that was a terrific moment. You know, today, 50 years later, I think the historical significance is more of an impact on me now than it was then. You realize what we did, and with old technology, and it kind of amazes me. It amazes me still that we were able to do what we did.
Former NASA flight controller Jerry Griffin. That momentous event during the summer of 1969 was, of course, set against the political backdrop of the Cold War. From a US standpoint, the first moon landings represented the climax of its space race against Russia. But unbeknown to the Americans, the Russians were making their own secret attempt to become the first nation to get to the lunar surface. The bid was uncovered by a small group of scientists at Britain's Jodrell Bank Observatory, as our science correspondent Victoria Gill explains.
On a July evening in 1969, four men gathered in a laboratory at Jodrell Bank, including the director of the Cheshire Radio Observatory, Professor Bernard Lovell, whose voice you can hear narrating these 50-year-old recordings.
That is the uplink from Houston.
That depends on your point of view.
The team had one of their radio telescopes trained on the Apollo 11 spacecraft.
Our prime work was watching the Russian moon probes.
Also in the room was Bob Pritchard, an engineer at Jodrell Bank.
That's how we came to be watching Luna 15.
So Luna 15 was the probe that the Russians were sending to the moon at the same time as the Americans were planning to send their astronauts to actually set foot on the moon.
That's right, yes.
Luna 15 has just emerged from behind the moon at the beginning of its 26th orbit. It is now lined up, and we have the impression that some further operation is impending.
As the small team discovered over the next 3 days in the lab, a race was underway 250,000 miles from Earth. Because as Apollo 11 approached the moon, Luna 15, the unmanned Russian probe, was already in orbit, apparently poised to land.
I am sure that their intention was to soft land, take a sample from the moon and get it back to Earth before the Apollo managed to, so that they could claim to have done it first and with no risk to human life. As far as Luna 15 was concerned, all one received was the telemetry.
Any signal they're getting from its instruments to say what state it's in and how it's operating.
That's right. When you came to Apollo, that was completely different.
182 inertial, I'm going inertial now.
You had the voices of the astronauts as they talked to ground control, and they retransmitted the voices of the ground controllers talking to the astronauts.
You could hear the whole conversation?
So you could hear both sides of the conversation.
Ready to copy LOI
2. This is Sunday, July the 20th. The sounds we can hear in the background are the commands from Luna 15th entering on its 39th orbit, and also the voices from the Apollo 11 spacecraft now in orbit around the moon about 2 hours before the separation of the lunar module from the mothercraft before the landing.
The Russian probe did eventually attempt to land on the moon's surface, but that's when the mission came to an untimely end.
Time is 15:50, 20 seconds.
Apollo 11 landed on the moon on the 20th of July at 8:15 in the evening. The following day, Luna 15 crashed onto the surface of the moon at 4:10 in the afternoon, and Apollo 11's liftoff was at 5:06, just 2 hours before Apollo 11 lifted off from the surface of the moon.
Well, that we believe to have been the landing of Luna 15, and nearby in the background, you'll hear the voices of the Apollo astronauts on the moon.
How much did it hit home, what you were witnessing?
I think it finally struck home when one saw the pictures on television of the astronauts returning to Earth. And then you walked out of your house and looked up into the sky and saw the moon and said, human beings have walked on that moon. And then you think, and I picked up the signals from them.
I say, this is really drama of the highest order.
That was the voice of Bob Pritchard, who was an engineer at Jodrell Bank in 1969. And those television pictures that he mentioned there were watched by millions of people around the world. It was described at the time as the greatest single broadcast in TV history. Richard Hamilton looks back at media coverage of those dramatic events 50 years ago.
街の通りにはかなり多くの人が見られますが、大多数の人はもちろんテレビを見られるホテルのロビーとか。
It's estimated that 500 million people gathered around TV sets across the globe to watch the Apollo 11 mission, and many millions more listened on the radio. On the streets of Tokyo, Paris, and Berlin, they watched and waited for the first man to set foot on the moon.
In just 50 minutes from now, well within the hour, the moon is due to have visitors from another planet.
Nearly half of America's 57 million televisions were tuned to CBS and Walter Cronkite. The anchorman was on air for 27 of the 30 hours it took for Apollo 11 to complete its mission. He was known as the most trusted man in America, and he'd had months to prepare. But when the Eagle spacecraft finally touched down, the veteran broadcaster was lost for words.
Man on the moon. Oh, boy.
Wait, we're
going to
be busy for a minute.
Wally, say something. I'm speechless.
Cronkite had to turn to his co-host, a former astronaut, Wally Schirra, to help him out. He later said he'd planned to say something more profound, but the words escaped him. Although it was a global TV viewing event, it passed off almost unnoticed in the Soviet Union. Here in Britain, commentary was provided by the BBC's James Burke.
At this moment, Apollo 11 is nearly 35,000 miles out from Earth and heading for the moon at 7,000 miles an hour. The crew are going to be a little bit less cold than we thought they were going to be. Just now, Mission Control asked them why the long period of radio silence, and they answered that wasn't radio silence, that was a sandwich in my mouth.
More than 4,000 journalists from around the world filled the press facilities of the Kennedy Space Centre, and there wasn't a motel room available within 100 kilometres. Variety magazine said it was the greatest story of all time, and proper coverage demanded the greatest news army ever collected in a single place. The three American television networks and four radio companies spent $13 million between them, a staggering amount of money at the time. Footage from the moon was provided by a colour TV camera aboard the command vehicle and a black and white model on the lunar module. The signal travelled to NASA's ground station in Australia and then on to a satellite over the Pacific. VIPs at Cape Canaveral included 400 members of Congress and their wives, 40 mayors, 19 governors, the Vice President Spiro Agnew and former President Lyndon Johnson. President Richard Nixon was not there as he had a cold. NASA was worried about germs spreading to crew members. These guests sat on wooden benches in an area of scrubland with no shade, no backrests, and no water supplies. The best seats to watch history unfolding were at home in front of the television.
That was Richard Hamilton. Time now for some of the other thoughts and musings of our listeners on the moon landings.
We heard about Elsa Modin from Sweden, who was a young space fan at the time of the moon landings and went on to work for Hasselblad. They're the Swedish firm that made the cameras NASA used. Thank you also to Pauline Ou at the University of Minnesota. She told us about Professor Emeritus Robert Pepin. He was one of the first people to study the rocks brought back from the moon. He and his colleague, Professor V. Ramamurthy, discovered a great deal about the chemical composition of the sun and the origins of the moon. Professor Pepin also made a decision that led to potassium-rich orange juice for astronauts. It was a bit of an anticlimax for some of the younger viewers. John Dillon went to watch it all on his grandma and granddad's small black-and-white TV. He was allowed to stay up very late to watch, but he nodded off, sleeping through the landing. Unlucky. Rahul was 5 at the time and his parents said it was too late and he wasn't allowed to watch it live. And he says, when I did see it repeated on TV the next day, another letdown. All these blurred, grainy images that you could barely make out. But in the weeks that followed, it sank in that something really special had happened. I remember our school teacher, who was about 35, telling us that when we reached her age, there'd be cities on the moon and that we'd be able to fly there on holiday, just as people flew from Britain to Spain or Greece. That still hasn't become a reality, he says, but I live in hope.
Ever since Apollo 11 carried the first astronauts to the moon, NASA has vowed it will surpass its most historic achievement, either by returning there with higher ambitions or by sending humans to Mars. But after half a century, America's space agency hasn't managed to turn its grand visions into reality. Could NASA's most prized accomplishment, the Apollo program, be partially to blame? Dotun Adebayo spoke to Dr. John Logsdon, founder of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University. He saluted the key decision by President John F. Kennedy.
I think he deserves full tribute for a very risky and very gutsy decision. I mean, the United States had only one 15-minute space flight under its belt when he announced his decision to go to the moon by the end of the decade.
Why would any president, though, take such a risk? The odds were probably against him at that point. And obviously, if that's going to be your legacy, a failure to get man on the moon, it would be remembered by history.
In a sense, Kennedy was forced into this decision. The Soviet Union had been first to launch a satellite in 1957 and then was first to launch a human in April of 61. And Nikita Khrushchev said our space achievements are indications of the superiority of the Soviet way of life. And we were in a zero-sum Cold War competition with the Soviet Union for global leadership. So they defined the playing field as space achievement. And Kennedy, after thinking about, is there any alternative, came to the conclusion that we had to play by their definition of the contest and said, all right, it's going to be space. He wrote a memo to his advisors on April the 20th, 61. He asked them to find, and I'll quote, a space program which promises dramatic results in which we could win. It was perceived as, say, a zero sum. Either we win or the Soviets win.
Was it get there at any cost then?
Fundamentally, yes. I mean, the NASA budget after Kennedy's speech in 61 went up 89%, and in the following year went up 101%. And those were remarkable warlike but peaceful mobilization of financial resources. Spaceflight is risky, and it was really a leadership initiative. I mean, the public opinion polls during the 60s showed somewhere between 40 and 55% in favor of spending the money to get to the moon. So there was never overwhelming public support for the venture.
And of course, then came November the 22nd in Dallas, Texas, and the president is assassinated. I wonder what happened then to the program. Did it take a knockback of any sort?
No, not at all. Kennedy's vice president, Lyndon Johnson, was one of the most enthusiastic of his advisors with respect to setting the lunar landing goal. And the program with the assassination became a memorial to the fallen young president. So there was basically no chance of it being canceled or slowed down.
Even though Richard Nixon, when he was elected in 1968, wasn't overly enthusiastic.
By that time, it was too late. The series of Apollo flights, the first flight was October of 68, before the election. The Apollo 8 mission around the moon at Christmas time, 1968, was before Nixon was in the White House. Nixon recognized that achieving the lunar landing goal would be a great bonus for American image and power, and he wanted to associate himself very closely with the achievement, in the process never mentioning Kennedy. Nixon very quickly got disenchanted with going to the moon. After Apollo 11 and Apollo 12, he was very happy when NASA proposed canceling a couple of the scheduled Apollo missions in 1970. And in fact, after Apollo 13, Nixon tried to cancel the last two missions, 16 and 17.
It does sound as if NASA and the mission to the moon had become something of a political football.
Well, the political football was what to do after Apollo. NASA proposed continuing a fast-paced program aiming at missions to Mars in the 1980s. And Nixon, I think, correctly recognized that there was even less public support for continuing that kind of program and said, no, we want a program that is much more modest in scope, still maintaining human spaceflight, but not with the kind of ambitious objectives that drove Apollo. And so it was he that basically reversed the trajectory of the U.S. space program to the budget level it has now, which is about one-tenth of what it had during the peak of Apollo. By defining the effort as a race to the moon, once you win the race, there's no reason to keep racing. And I think that was what the American public perceived. We won. Let's quit and use our money for something else. The worldwide reaction to Apollo was more positive than the reaction in the United States at the time. The Apollo 11 crew did a global tour after their mission, and we found everybody said, we did it, you know, seen as a step for humanity.
What is the legacy of the Apollo 11 mission?
The American historian Arthur Schlesinger called Apollo 11 the most significant event of the 20th century. And the Apollo program, the one thing that will be remembered 500 years from now. Does that seem to be reasonable given where we are now and the fact that we've not been back to the moon since 1972? You know, Columbus's ventures to the New World were followed by a wave of settlement and development, and that hasn't happened. So I think the jury's still out whether Apollo 11 was the first step in a centuries-long human movement into the solar system, or basically a dead end that happened once and didn't really lead anywhere.
Dr. John Logsdon, and we will pick up that question a little later in this podcast. Still to come, these gloves are really, really hard to do anything in. This is much harder than it looks. Ow! I'll be playing around at the Science Museum in London. So let's focus now on what happened in the wake of the Apollo mission program. Far from being the end of space exploration, it prompted a desire to go even further than the moon. Much further, in fact, to the outer reaches of our solar system and beyond, but this time using robots. A man who knows all about our recent forays into space is Professor John Czarnecki, past president of the Royal Astronomical Society, and he's been talking to Oliver Conway.
In the immediate period after the Apollo program finished, the big thing that happened in space exploration was the very iconic Voyager missions. There were two spacecraft, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, which took advantage of an alignment of the planets that only happens once every 175 years, and that occurred in the late 70s. So that gave the opportunity for these two spacecraft to do essentially a complete tour of the outer solar system. And they flew past Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and gave us fabulous close-up images of Saturn's rings, for example. We saw really for the first time the rich retinue of satellites or moons that go around Jupiter and Saturn. You know, we learnt about Europa and Io, the most volcanic satellite in the solar system, the most volcanic place in the solar system. So that kick-started, to some extent, the whole business of robotic exploration of the solar system. And it went on from there.
And why was it that after the excitement of seeing humans on the moon, that it became automated? Was it just because they were going so much further that only robots could do it?
Yes. The reality is that certainly in the foreseeable future, humans will not be able to go beyond Mars. I mean, we haven't even achieved Mars yet with humans. So we have now, in the ensuing 50 years, we've essentially been to every part pretty much of the solar system, except the outermost reaches. You know, we've visited now every planet, most or all of the important moons of the planets of the solar system. We've been to comets, we've landed on a comet, and also we've been to asteroids and even brought back material from, in fact, both a comet and an asteroid. And it's not entirely due to Apollo, but I think in Apollo, the program gave us, if you like, the nerve to do it, you know, the confidence. If we could land humans on the moon, surely we could do almost anything. So that was almost a psychological boost. And the other aspect, I think, is a practical element. You know, to land men on the moon, it took about 400,000 people. And just imagine the incredible task of managing and organizing. It's a stupendous task, and it was successful. And I think many of the techniques that we learned in that program were then applied to these similarly very complex projects of robotic exploration.
You mentioned the Voyager missions. Those have now both left the solar system. And you also spoke about how we've landed on a comet. I mean, it is quite incredible what humans have achieved in space now.
It is staggering. And although that got a lot of publicity, of course, it's not the same as astronauts landing. However, these are remarkable events. And another aspect which I think is particularly interesting is that in those early days, the Apollo days, it really was pretty much only the United States and, as it was then, the Soviet Union, who were significant players in space. Now, it's changed a lot since then. It's absolutely true that the United States is still the largest player. There's no doubt of that. But there are lots of other players now and significant ones. For example, ESA, the European Space Agency, which I would say from the early 80s has played a very, very significant role in space exploration. More recently, we have China. They, in the last few years, of course, soft landed on the far side of the moon. And Japan have a spacecraft, Hayabusa 2, which is currently sampling an asteroid and will be returning to Earth next year with hopefully some more samples from the asteroid. India has sent its robotic orbiter to the moon, Chandrayaan, and has a mission orbiting Mars at the moment. So it is not just two players anymore. And also I'd point out that certainly as scientists, there are almost no boundaries. We work collaboratively. It's almost second nature. And so many of these missions, you know, we might say it's an Indian mission, it's a European mission, but there will be often significant contributions from other nations.
Professor John Czarnecki. So that's where we are now, remotely and robotically exploring some of the furthest reaches of the galaxy. So what is next in terms of space exploration? There are ambitions to get people to Mars. And what about the moons of Jupiter, or even beyond into the depths of interstellar space itself? One man who believes very strongly that we should, and indeed must, do it, simply in order for mankind to survive, is futurist Professor Machio Kaku. He spoke to Julian Marshall.
You know, the dinosaurs did not have a space program. And that's why the dinosaurs are not here today to talk about it. And it's a law of physics that we do eventually have to leave the Earth. In about 5 billion years from now, the sun will eat up the Earth. We will have the last night's day. The mountains will melt. The oceans will boil. The sky will be on fire. And we will go back into the sun. So it's inevitable, given self-inflicted problems like global warming and nuclear proliferation, as well as natural disasters that are planetary, that we do eventually have to leave the Earth and begin the process of exploring the universe. It's a law of physics.
But not so far away as 5 billion years. More immediately, you argue.
Yes, when you take a look at meteor asteroid impacts, we're talking about another dinosaur-killing asteroid hitting the Earth in maybe about 50 million years. And then you talk about volcanic eruptions that could take place. That takes place on a scale of tens of thousands of years. And then we have self-inflicted problems like biogerms that may escape from the laboratory and infect most of the people on the planet Earth if they're weaponized. And so what I'm saying is we need a backup plan, Plan B, an insurance policy. We don't need to bankrupt the Earth in order to colonize outer space. That costs too much money. But a insurance policy, a settlement, settlement on the moon and Mars is definitely a possibility.
Settlement on Mars, incredibly ambitious with the state of current technology.
With the state of current funding, the answer is yes. But costs are dropping. That's the whole key. We now have Silicon Valley billionaires like Jeff Bezos, richest man on the earth, Elon Musk of SpaceX, also, of course, Richard Branson of Virgin Atlantic. that want to reduce the cost of space travel. You know the movie The Martian? A movie about going to Mars costs more than actually going to Mars on a space probe. That's how much the economics of space travel have changed.
So it's getting cheaper to go into space, but technology is still not up to the challenge.
There's no problem in physics. It's an engineering problem because, well, to go to the moon only took 3 days, a hop, skip, and a jump to the moon. To go to Mars would take about 6 to 9 months for a one-way trip to Mars. And that, of course, is an engineering problem because we've already done that with robots. Now we have to put in life support. We have to make sure that our astronauts can come back safely. But as far as the physics is concerned, there's no law of physics preventing us from launching a manned mission to Mars.
But Mars is uninhabitable.
At the present time, but the thinking is that at one point in the distant past, Mars was habitable. It had running water, and it was tropical. Tropical even before the Earth became tropical. But of course, it lost its atmosphere. Now people are realizing that we are terraforming the Earth. Humans are actually interfering with the atmosphere of the planet Earth. So it is possible to actually change the atmosphere. We are doing that with the Earth right now. What we really want to do is terraform Mars. Now that, of course, is a whole different ball of wax. We're not talking about decades to centuries to begin the process of terraforming Mars. But there are plans, at least in theory, to do that. For example, satellites can direct solar energy to the ice caps of Mars, which have plenty of water, melt them, and begin the process of thickening the atmosphere, creating an artificial greenhouse effect, and recreating the oceans of Mars.
So talk me through some of the other technology that is available, could become available, to make these ambitious journeys into outer space.
Well, first of all, we have the technology from computers. We have to first realize that the microchip was made possible because of the Apollo space program. So the very fact that we have the computer revolution of today is in some sense a byproduct of the space program. Now, realize that your cell phone today has more computer power than all of NASA in 1969, which means that we have better communications, better technologies, better safety systems in order to make sure that a mission to Mars would be successful. So realize that we're not talking about the old Saturn rocket of 1969. We're talking about a new generation of rockets, rockets that are reusable, rockets that are high-tech, and rockets that will use artificial intelligence.
Professor Michio Kaku, theoretical physicist and futurist, who sounds improbably cheerful about boiling oceans, burning skies, and weaponized germs. We asked you for your recollections of the moon landings, and this one is from Frank Ortega, who was in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, when the Eagle touched down on the moon.
I was 9. It was a hot July summer, and we were on holiday. I'd always been lured by outer space and the possibilities of the impossible, so I'll never forget sitting inside on the cool tile floor that Sunday afternoon, with the windows open and the doors open for a breeze. It was a tiny television set, a little bigger than a bread box, and I sat a few feet away from it just to be as close as possible for what I couldn't believe was about to happen. It was all in black and white, and so grainy that it was as if I was watching through the sand that blew in from outside. I honestly don't remember if there was anyone else with me, but I do remember that no one spoke. There was an electricity of history that connected us all in that moment. A door had been opened into a possible future, and there was no turning back. I knew that the same sun was shining down on them up there as it was on all of us down here, and that night I would be compelled outside again to look at the stars and think how everything had changed. I can't believe it's been half a century.
So we know the names of the first men in space and on the moon, but what about the women? In 1963, the Soviet cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova became the first woman in space, just 2 years after Yuri Gagarin's first human crewed flight. But as investment in the space programs grew, so did the gender gap. It took another 19 years until another female Soviet cosmonaut, Svetlana Savitskaya, became the second woman to travel into space. Savitskaya returned on a 1984 mission to become the first woman to fly to space twice and the first woman to perform a spacewalk. While over 500 people have flown in space to date, only 11% of them have been women. That's why the organisers of a new exhibition here in London entitled The Moon have one feature devoted entirely to the role of women in space. I caught up with its curator, Melanie Vandenbroek.
Here we have a still image from a film called The First Woman on the Moon from 1999 by an artist called Alexandra Meir. In 1999, 30 years after the moon landing, Alexandra Meir reflected on the fact that if a woman wants to land on the moon, she will have to build it for herself. And it's indeed what she did. She took over a beach in the Netherlands, and with a bunch of volunteers, some of them driving large bulldozers and caterpillars, but also children wielding spades, and unsuspecting tourists helped us to transform these beach into a lunar landing site with craters and ridges and valleys and so on and so forth. As the sun set down, she climbed a dune, proclaimed herself first woman on the moon, and then she was followed by the first German on the moon, the first black man on the moon, the first gay man on the moon. Now, what this rather tongue-in-cheek work is doing is questioning the status quo and opening it up, thinking about who's been on the moon thus far. 12 white American men, all of them test pilots, but for one man who was a geologist. What does it say for all mankind? This is what she's been asking then. To this day, if you look up first woman on the moon on a search engine, she will still be the first hit. And when you ask her, she says she can't wait to be replaced by an actual person of flesh and blood who will step on the surface of the moon.
So the people who've been on the moon so far have all been men, but there were women who were key, pivotal in the Apollo 11 mission.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I think it's important to remember that 400,000 people were involved in the Apollo space program. So whilst we know about the astronauts, we know the 24 who went in orbit, the 12 who stood on the moon, there were many more people involved before then. And these ranged from engineers to architects to cooks to seamstresses. For instance, the Apollo spacesuits were made by seamstresses. They had been designed by ILC, who's better known offshoot is Playtext, maker of girdles and underwear. And their role was absolutely pivotal in making sure that these men would remain alive, because a spacesuit is like an actual spacecraft, and it had to be absolutely weatherproof, airproof, had to be able to protect those men against radiation and so on and so forth. So every single stitch mattered. And as a woman who's really important is Margaret Hamilton, who was a software engineer who was leading the team who wrote the code for the Apollo 11 spacecraft and helped those men to land on the moon. And certainly in the final minutes before descent, those computers were absolutely crucial in helping Neil Armstrong making the right decisions. And then you also had the mathematicians, someone like Katherine Johnson, who had to overcome racial segregation as well as gender segregation in the segregated South in the 1960s in America. And she was the person who, for instance, plotted the trajectory and the orbital flight of those missions. She was incredibly important. So women were really absolutely crucial to the space program, and they were involved in absolutely every aspect you can think of.
Melanie Vandenbroek, curator at London's Royal Maritime Museum. Well, the next person on the moon is expected to be a woman, and I am here at the Science Museum in anticipation of that call from NASA. When you are out in space, you need to carry out lots of detailed and delicate operations, and you need to do it wearing these ridiculously large and not terribly easily manipulated gloves. Now, what they've got in here is some screws and things. So imagine you are out there in space, in weightlessness, and if you drop a screw or a nut or a bolt, which is, oh, what I just did, I'm just going to pick that up again. I'm going to try and pick that up again. It could get you into all sorts of trouble. This is much harder than it looks. Ow! I'm standing in front of the command module simulator for the Apollo 10. And it is pretty mind-boggling, I have to say. If you thought that a radio desk was complicated, this is in a different stratosphere, pun intended. You've got hundreds of dials and switches and knobs, and reassuringly, one big button on the left marked abort. It's all a bit alarming, really. I'm not sure that I'm necessarily cut out for space travel. Oh, my goodness me. I want this. This is a backpack, but it's not just any backpack. It's a jetpack. It's white. It's got little rocket blasters with red and yellow flames coming out of the bottom and fuel capsules at the back. I actually want this. I think this is actually meant for children aged 6 to 10. I'm small. I can get away with this. I like this. It works for me. Let's end on a note of lunar cultural nostalgia. Before humans got to the moon, they talked, wrote, and sang about it. That fascination hasn't let up since 1969 either. Jonathan Savage takes us through some of the ways the moon has had an impact on our artistic heritage.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars.
Fly Me to the Moon was written by Bart Howard in 1954, 15 years before anyone actually did it. It's wistful and romantic, especially in the hands of Frank Sinatra, and presents a view of our natural satellite undimmed by science, or should that be, unilluminated. It may have been the last time we saw the moon that way. As far as humans are concerned, it's always been there, physically out of reach but tantalisingly close. Close enough, in fact, that features of its terrain could be made out with the naked eye. We could always see just enough to fire our imagination, but not so much as to smother it. The moon was a thing of legend before becoming an object of scientific intrigue. Some believed it controlled our destinies. We learned it controlled our oceans. Somewhere in between, the moon took on a third role, an artistic muse. In 1865, at the point of human development where getting to the moon moved from absurdity to mere fantasy, Jules Verne's novel From the Earth to the Moon made some spectacular predictions. More on them to come. The ancient superstitious view of the moon pervades popular culture. This is Bad Moon Rising by Creedence Clearwater Revival. So we've had bad moons, Neil Young had his harvest moon, and numerous artists, including Billie Holiday, were seen and known by a blue moon.
Blue moon, you saw me standing alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own.
The first time we reached the moon on film was in 1902, a French science fiction movie named Le Voyage dans la Lune. By 1968, the year before Apollo 11, the idea of space travel had evolved to allow us to imagine what could go wrong. In 2001, A Space Odyssey, directed by Stanley Kubrick, is still, for many, the finest science fiction film ever made. It gives the audience cause to reflect on life, human, alien, and artificial. 1969 was the year we learned the truth about the moon. It wasn't far from fiction. Remember Jules Verne? He wrote of a crew of three being sent by the United States with technology remarkably similar to what was eventually used and splashing back down in the Pacific Ocean. Released the very week of the moon landing, David Bowie's Space Oddity mixed the romance of the future with added poignancy. Getting to the moon didn't suppress our desire to fictionalise adventures in space. Star Trek's original series was cancelled just months before the moon landing, but in other iterations, both on TV and in cinemas, continues to explore strange new worlds, to boldly go. Space travel has given us inspiration for drama and comedy, for live action and animation. In Toy Story, Buzz Lightyear's sights are set a little higher than the moon.
To infinity and beyond!
The film Moon from 2009 expresses a lonely, industrial vision where a man comes to terms with his possible demise. It was directed by Duncan Jones, David Bowie's son, which brings us nicely back into orbit. In the face of all evidence, some say we never did go to the moon, not really. When REM sang of it in 1992, they mixed spaceflight with history, mythology and conspiracy in a collage of human creativity. It tells us that the lump of rock in the sky is just a part of our story, whether or not you believe the fact that we really did put a man on the moon.
Jonathan Savage, ending this special edition of the Global News podcast, marking the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission that first put man on the moon. Today's producer was Nikki Verrico. Our thanks to the Science Museum in London and the National Maritime Museum, and to all of you who sent in your moon landing musings. The next edition will return to more terrestrial matters. That's tomorrow. I'm Jackie Leonard from me and Nikki and the Science Museum. Goodbye.